Hello, and welcome to this edition of the Fair Data Podcast, where we discuss all things FAIR, making data findable, accessible, interoperable, and reusable. I'm Rory McNeil, host of the Fair Data Podcast.
And my guest today is Katie McNeil, DataWorks Director at the Federation of American Societies for Experimental Biology, known as FASEB, in the DataWorks program. Katie, welcome. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me on, Rory. We have so many related interests. It's just great to be able to talk to you about our work. And one of the things I really enjoy about being part of the global research data community is being able to talk with people like you about things that we work on together.
Absolutely. It's definitely one of the most pleasurable aspects, and actually sometimes the most, the most informative as well. I'm looking forward to hearing, really looking forward to hearing about the exciting work going on in the DataWorks program. But first of all, I know you've recently moved from the Harvard Business School, which is also an interesting organization, and you're a research data program manager before the recent move to FASEB. So tell us a bit about what you were doing at HBS.
Yeah, so it's a multifaceted role. I was working in the library there, and Harvard as a large institution has many dedicated services that are based at the different schools. So I was both focused on the needs of the researchers of the business school, but also in concert and collaboration with people at the university level. So I coordinated the library's research data program, which is a cross-departmental matrix program of library services supporting research data across the lifecycle, and then also served as liaison to other groups supporting data both at the school. We had great partners with our research computing department and also with people across the university who are working on data services. So for example, I know your inaugural podcast attendance was by Julie Goldman in the Harvard Medical School, and I'd worked with her and other entities on research data services and data governance. And then another wing of my work was in negotiating data use agreements for faculty looking to acquire novel data sets from outside entities, ones that hadn't been used in research before, blazing the trail for that and ensuring that those agreements were tailored to research use.
Yeah, interesting. So that actually fits with my recollection, which was a very broad role. As it happens, our guest, a few weeks ago, we had someone else from Harvard, Sonia Barbosa from Dataverse. And I know that in addition to the things you mentioned, you worked with the Dataverse team during your time at Harvard, because that's how we first met.
Yeah.
So for me, the kind of engagement I've had with the Dataverse team and the community has actually been really informative of the way I think about a lot of aspects of research data management. So how did it inform your understanding of both of repositories and of the role that repositories play in research data management?
Absolutely, yes. And I was really glad to have had many opportunities to collaborate with the Dataverse team at Harvard. And in fact, my connection with them goes back far before my time at Harvard, when I was working in data services at MIT, because for a long time, MIT has been a partner with the Institute for Quantitative Social Science on a set of services. So I've known Sonia and her team for a long time. And in fact, I worked with their staff in the first iteration of Dataverse as they were sort of testing and developing the system, helping to test it myself and work with researchers to think about that model. And I think one of the things that I learned is the fact that data repositories can have different approaches to its processes and especially its roles and responsibilities and curation services. So, for example, there's a long history of really robust data archives, for example, in the social sciences. So I know later we'll talk about my work at the UK Data Archive, and that's over 50 years old. And so there's a long tradition in really robust archiving and services for research data, especially in the social sciences. And also in recent years, I've seen different repository models emerge, and Dataverse was really pivotal in sort of pioneering the self-deposit and self-management model on the part of researchers in parallel to, and it's sort of a different model from formally large staffed data archives, which provide different kinds of services and is less of a self-service model. And I think it shows the variety and the spectrum of the different ways and standards that you can have among what is the responsibility of archiving and repository professionals and of researchers in managing and providing access to their own data. And that it's not necessarily one extreme or the other, that you often see different aspects and hybrid models. So for example, DANZ, which is the primary data archive in the Netherlands, also sort of a peer to the UK data archive, has managed data for many, many decades, and also has rolled out Dataverse for its section of its repository that focuses on researcher self-deposits. So I think that there are a lot of different hybrid models of data repositories, and Dataverse provided an entree into thinking about them differently.
That's fascinating. Yeah. I hadn't actually realized that aspect of what data, because I know Dataverse is doing a lot of innovative things, but I hadn't realized that kind of fundamental distinction. And as soon as you mention it, of course, it's instantly understandable what the point is.
Yeah. And I really think that there's a role for both, and it's not an either or competition.
Yeah, I suppose. And then Zenodo would be another example of a self-curated, automatic user deposit driven kind of approach. But then some of the other ones, like Dryad, I think might be, which is more tied into publications, is more on the curation side, and then others, which I don't know anything about, probably as well. But yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah,
that's actually really useful. Distinguishing characteristic to help sort them out, because there are quite a few of them.
And also, that it's not necessarily a binary of, self-managed versus staff-managed. There are lots of different qualities of data repositories. And as you said, Dryad takes another different approach for more thorough integration with publications, so that there's a diversity of different attributes, and it's not necessarily that you can pin them into different categories, and that Dataverse help to think about different ways of running things.
Ah, okay. Really interesting. So that's just one example of why I think my observation was that your time at the Harvard Business School sounded pretty interesting, but I guess you must have been looking for a new challenge. So what attracted you about the FASF DataWorks program?
Yeah, so I'm, always looking to challenge myself and grow professionally, both in sort of the data sphere and also just in running organizations and programs. And on an aside, a design to sort of learn that further, and a desire on my part led me to get an MBA part-time whilst I was working at Harvard, and thinking about how to apply that knowledge of running programs and organizations in another kind of setting. So I've worked in research data for over 20 years, primarily in libraries and archives. And FASF was an exciting opportunity for me in a couple different ways. One is there are so many different kinds of stakeholder organizations in the field of research data and research infrastructure. You have research institutions, libraries, archives, funders, publishers, infrastructure providers, and scholarly societies like FASIB. And so it was an ability to work in the same field, but for a different kind of organization. There's a really growing movement of scholarly societies thinking about what's the leadership role that we can play in research data to contribute to that, and to bring my skills to a different setting to both contribute those skills and to learn new things. And then FASIB is actually interesting because it's not necessarily only a singular scholarly society, it's a federation, so a society of societies. So that's even a more interesting and complex environment. So that's one reason. I think another one is the perspective of being able to serve a very broad global community, in addition to my experience in working in depth in a single university. That's great. And also, it's a different kind of contribution to be looking more globally. That's one of the things I liked about when I worked at the UK Data Archive, was providing a global service to many different institutions. And FASIB is really the same, to be able to serve researchers worldwide. And we're at a point where we're growing and launching a new service. It's one of our two strategic initiatives, along with our diversity, equity, and inclusion program. And we're building a team. I'll mention later that I'm sort of hiring another staff member, and to be able to work with those staff and manage them and help a team think about how to grow and launch a service to be able to provide a unique contribution. And I think lastly, I think the approach that FASIB is looking to have really aligns with my philosophies of collaboration, that FASIB, and certainly me with my experience, is very, very well aware that we are not inventing the field of research data management. We needn't reinvent the wheel. And that what we're looking to do is to provide a unique contribution in collaboration with others, and in a way that brings together stakeholders in the field, different organizations that are working. And that's both an efficient way to work and a really collaborative way to work. That I know that there are so many different organizations, many of whom you've had on the podcast, they're doing really active work in this area. And we're really looking to see how we can contribute and add value in partnership with others.
Great. Thank you. That's all really interesting. As I was listening to you speak, I was reflecting on the fact that it might be useful to take a step back and just at a kind of concrete level describe not so much the DataWorks program, but actually what FASEB, what is FASEB, because probably a lot of people won't actually know that.
Yes. So again, it's the Federation of American Societies for Experimental Biology, and it was started over 100 years ago by smaller scholarly societies in specific fields, such as the American Physiological Society, who wanted to come together to do a set of programs and services in a collective way that made sense to do as a broader group, as opposed to just doing things on their own. And it's grown from there, and we have, I believe at the moment, 28 member societies that range from, as I said, physiological societies to sports medicine to toxicology to like a society that represents research cores, and that come together to work on a number of different main areas. One is science policy, so helping to ensure that the federal government, in the way it's implementing laws and regulations, is well aware of the needs of scientists. We run conferences and journals, and then the society is always looking to see, as many organizations are, how is the field changing? What are the ways that we should be expanding or changing our portfolio to serve the needs of our research community even more? And so a year or so ago, it was decided to launch a new strategic initiatives program, with DataWorks being one. As I mentioned, our other one is the Diversity, Equity, Accessibility, and Inclusion Initiative. And those are both important programs that the smaller societies themselves, they don't necessarily have the capacity to have dedicated staff in these specialized areas. But knowing that those two are both very prominent, important areas in the research fields, and having a centralized service in the Federation helps the Federation centrally and all the societies think about how we can contribute to these specific fields.
Okay, fantastic. So coming to your specific focus, I really love the DataWorks salons you're running, and I've attended a number, and I always look forward to them. I think they're great. So tell us a bit about how they're organized. How do you select topics for discussion? What kinds of people are attending? Give us a flavor for what they're all about.
Yes. So the salons are one of four pillars of the DataWorks program, and the purpose of them is to create conversation spaces for the biological and biomedical community to exchange ideas and design effective practices for research data sharing and reuse. And our DataWorks community manager, Emily Ruff, runs this program. And we actually just had our first anniversary for DataWorks, hurrah, last month in September. And that includes a year of these salons. It was one of the first programs that we rolled out. And one of the philosophies in the design of DataWorks, and what is the role, again, of FASEB in this field, is to be a convener among researchers and key players in the community. And so what we're looking to do with the series is bring in experts in the field to be able to communicate to researchers, and also really to try to involve the researchers themselves in the conversation as much as possible as participants and not simply attendees. And so our format that we've often gone with is a combination of researchers who are working on a certain topic and experts in that field. So for example, the last one we had was data repositories, and we had a researcher talking about the choices that they had made in their lab around how to store research data, both during the active phase of research and when they would choose repositories for long-time storage and preservation, as well as people who were experts. And one of the things that we're looking to do is to cover both sort of fundamentals of research data management, sharing, and reuse. And especially in the coming year, we'll be delving into detailed and specific topics in the areas of biology and biomedicine that we focus on in FASEB. And then the people who have been attending are, I would say, a combination of researchers and people such as you and I in the field who are looking to keep up with what we're doing. And as with our program in general, we're really looking to hear from the community as to what they're looking to have from these kinds of programs. Again, if you search for webinars on research data management, there are a multitude, and we want to build on and complement those others. So we're in the process of planning our salons for 2023 and really eager to hear from the community as to what value we can provide and what kinds of specialized topics we can host on that may not be covered already in other conversation spaces.
Yeah, that's good. That's Well, I'll hopefully be attending and also following with interest how it kind of evolves and getting feedback from, if you're able to get useful feedback from interested people, that will help shape it in practical and useful directions, I think. So that's excellent.
Yeah.
Good. Just a kind of a high level, just briefly, what other kinds of activities you said DataWorks, the salons are what, apart from the salons, DataWorks is doing other things as well. Is that right?
Exactly. So it was designed and launched with four pillars in mind that are within the themes of community building, incentives, and culture change. And that's the role that FASB can play in this field. So for example, people say, oh, is FASB running a data repository? Well, no, because we feel like that's covered well in the field, and our role can be in bringing together people in the community, helping to make things easier for researchers and connecting them with services that are helpful. So the salons are part of that. And we have two of our four pillars are currently running. So the salons, as we talked about. And then we have the DataWorks Prize pillar. And that's a program to recognize and provide financial incentives and resources for research teams who integrate data sharing and reuse to advance human health. And the goal is really to both change the reward structure for data to make it more valuable for researchers to be able to do this, because many want to be able to manage their data better, share their data. It's not for lack of a desire or motivation or goodwill, but simply pragmatically, there might not be the kinds of incentives and rewards that enable that work. So to be able to do that kinds of work, to reward those activities, and in the way that collects information about those successes and shares it back with the research community. That the prize program is also run by our community manager, Emily Ruff, who has experience in running prizes at other organizations. So she's a real gem. And we have two wings of the prize program. I'd like to say generally on the different ends of the data lifecycle spectrum. So when you think about the beginning of the lifecycle, a lot of researchers want or need to create data management plans. For example, many in the community are anticipating the rollout of the National Institutes of Health, NIH, data management and sharing requirement that's coming out this upcoming January that will require researchers that participate in all NIH grants to put forward a data management plan. So we have a challenge that's being run in collaboration with the National Networks of Libraries of Medicine that rewards researchers who produce exemplary data management plans in the field for the National Institutes of Health. And we have cash prizes available both for the plans themselves, but in the interest of working, as I mentioned, we're working with this library consortium, one of the roles that we want to play is to connect researchers with services available to them and to lift up information about those services to the community. So if you write an exemplary data management plan and you work with your local data librarian on that, you're eligible for an additional $500 prize. So really that's kind of rewarding not only doing the work, but availing yourself of the resources, I think helps to do that. And we have our second round of that running. And I will say that that's actually the deadline for that is this Friday, October 21st. So if you have sort of a draft NIH data management plan somewhere in your file system, give it a go, submit it. And it's a great way to be able to think about how to plan, not simply for the requirement, but how to think about planning for this as serving your own needs as a researcher. So that's one of the wings. And then towards the other end of the life cycle, we have the DataWorks Prize, which is in partnership and with funding from the NIH Office of Data Science Strategy. And that's designed to recognize and reward leaders that have shared or reused research data in the process of research to be able to learn from their achievements.
Fantastic. Proliferation of tools. Well, I think data management plans and repositories are the two ones which people think about. Of course, there are others as well. But it's really interesting. And I think one of the things that I enjoyed about the salons is that they get into the nitty gritty of how these things are used and practiced by actual researchers. So it's always interesting. Yeah.
Yes. And if I may add, again, both of those are designed to collect information about these research successes and share them back with the research community, because a lot of researchers may not be aware of the extent to which their peers are sharing and reusing data and need information on examples for that. And in for the DataWorks Prize, the larger prize that's being sponsored by the National Institutes of Health, that will be announced in January of 2023. And then we'll be using the year to celebrate them and share their practices in a series of events. And then what's also coming up next are we have two other planned pillars of DataWorks. One that's coming farther in the future is our Fellows Program, which is designed to be able to train and upskill a small focus set of biological and biomedical researchers and teams to hone their skill and mentor their peers in data management and sharing. So we're in the process of planning that for the medium term. But the immediate thing that's coming up next is that we will be launching our DataWorks Help Desk, which will be designed to provide guidance for the biological and biomedical research community to navigate and adopt data sharing and reuse policies and practices. And we're looking to launch a pilot this year in a really experimental way. As I was saying before, we're looking to put out an experiment and get really active input and feedback so that we can develop it in the way that the research community really needs.
Excellent. Well, that's exciting.
Yes, it is. And we'll be hiring another. We have a job posting out there that will still be available when the podcast debuts for a manager to manage the help desk, looking to grow it over time, thinking about how we can serve our researchers in this multimodal way. As my colleague Emily Ruff has said, people are looking to get advice from FACIB on these topics. They may attend a salon. They may choose to look up information, or ask a question about our help desk, and thinking about how we build a team that provides integrated set of services across all those modes.
Yeah, good. Well, you know, one of my constant themes is interoperability and integration. So I'm sure it will be the case, but that the help desk provides not just looking at, say, here's how you do a data management plan, but here's how you think about a data management plan in the course of the entire research lifecycle, and other things like repositories and other tools. And I think that that's a perspective which sometimes the people working in libraries don't have necessarily the luxury of taking a step back and thinking about the bigger picture, because they're so focused on helping people with very concrete individual tasks. So this is just a little bit of a gratuitous advice here, or a request. If you're able to get the help desk to think in a kind of a big picture way, and then integrate in different aspects, different tools, different things, I think that would actually be quite a unique. Well, not unique, but, you know, a relatively unusual service, which would be useful, but also would distinguish you from other organizations like universities that are providing advice. So there's an off-the-cuff reflection on what you said, because I wasn't aware of that.
that's a great point. And I'll comment on that, and then I'm squeezing something else I forgot to say that's coming up is, I think you make a great point, and that's in line with the way that we're already thinking and we're having conversations with, say, stakeholders such as librarians at different universities, talking to them about the help desk and how it can be developed in a way that complements and is layered on top of the services that they do, so that we're not looking to replace what they're doing or compete with their help desks, but thinking about how can we provide additional services to the researchers and also the research service providers. You know, what can we do in our help desk that helps a librarian out there on the ground or a research computing staff member or a data governance professional do their own work?
Yeah. Fantastic. That's good.
Yeah. And then another thing that's exciting that's coming is in the field of, as you were saying, sort of interconnections and collaboration, is we're looking to participate in broader open science conversations that include issues of data management sharing and beyond. So FASB has just joined the launch of the Alliance for Open Scholarship, which is a diverse group of professional societies and associations that's just launched a bold initiative to advance open scholarship in a broad way, including thinking about research data. And again, that's focused on a collaboration of professional scholarly societies looking to see what is the role that we can play that enhances and adds to what's going on in the field. So it'll be exciting to see what comes out of that.
Great. So changing tack a little bit, you're also a board member at ORCID, and I'm sure that's really fascinating, in particular because there seems to be, from the outside at least, a lot happening in the ORCID world just now. So can you tell us a bit about some of the main initiatives that are in place and those that are coming up?
Yes, yeah, it's really exciting because ORCID has very quickly become a real pivotal tool in research infrastructure that can be used in all kinds of ways that we don't even anticipate yet. I keep thinking every week different kinds of ways that you can use ORCID. We're looking to integrate it into our help desk, for example. So one of the important new things ORCID has launched is thinking about a global infrastructure provider and how global infrastructure systems can think about the way that research is done globally and the way that that is or is not equitable and how we as infrastructure providers can try to advance the equity. So there was recently, a few months ago, the launch of the Global Participation Program, which is an ORCID initiative with the support and funding of many partners to be able to improve the equity of access to interconnected research infrastructures across the globe. And it has two wings. One is the Global Participation Fund, which are grants for either community development or technical integration to be able to enable countries in the global south, which are currently underrepresented, to be able to increase the ability to uptake and participate in ORCID. And then we also have a membership equity program, which is designed to provide fee discounts to organizations in lower and middle income countries. Because before we had more of a homogenous fee structure, and the realization that we need to think about how the global research community works, how that infrastructure and economy and ecosystem works so that we can maximize the uptake of these services in a way that works for the stakeholder organizations. So that's one important thing we're doing. And then the other thing is we are marking our 10-year anniversary. And I can't believe in some ways it's only been 10 years because ORCID already feels so fundamental and core to everything. I feel like it must be at least several decades. So there's going to be a bunch of 10th anniversary opportunities, which is very exciting.
Okay. Fantastic. So, I mean, ORCID is a reflection. ORCID, there's a lot going on at ORCID, and ORCID's what's happening, and some of the things that are happening at ORCID's are a reflection of the fact that in a short period of time, 10 years, or roughly 10 years, PIDs generally have gone from being a niche topic to becoming a center, and in some ways, the center of interest, I think, in the research data management world. So you've got an interesting perspective. Everyone has their own perspective, I guess, on this, but yours is particularly interesting. And how do you see the role of PIDs evolving in the next couple of years?
Yeah, you know, I think that one of them is a continuation of an existing theme where, you know, back in the day when I started actively in research data, thinking about data was, compared to now, relatively separate from thinking about other kinds of research outputs. But as the time has gone on, there's much more integration, thinking about how research outputs are interconnected. That's something that the PID community has certainly been thinking about and developing infrastructure around, you know, linking data and publications and research organizations and researchers and funders, and that there may be increased ways to think about those beyond research outputs, but also thinking about tracking research objects and research entities. Since working from FACIB, I've learned more about research identifiers in the biomedical field, such as RRIDs, which are ways of tracking different kinds of research resources that have been used, and how we can extend earlier into the research lifecycle to think about not only research outputs, but also research objects and things that are used throughout the lifecycle, and how you track, use that information to track the way that research is done across the lifecycle in a way that's a little bit easier for researchers to keep track of what they've been doing and the tasks that they've done, and how things are more interconnected, not only among different kinds of research outputs at the end, but among the life cycle. And I think, and one of the things we'll be interested in doing that is, in addition to wanting things to be in a structured way, I'm also aware of sometimes the sort of realistic messiness of research. So for example, when I was at the Harvard Business School, I was working with one of my colleagues in research computing on potential infrastructure for tracking research projects at the school, with a research project being a distinct entity that may get sort of an internal identifier, and that you would be able to track that research project throughout different infrastructures in the school. When you have a research computing environment, it's related to that project, and you're serving the researchers, and you can notice that the questions that you're answering for them are related to X project, tracking the research outputs associated with it, and that it could be a useful vehicle for tracking entities related to a project. And that's true. And also, the more we talked, the more we realized that many researchers don't necessarily consider their research projects having a very extremely discrete border around them, and that sometimes a project will sort of morph into another one, or the dividing line between when one project starts and the one ends is not quite as discrete as sort of the worlds of metadata and PIDs might like. And so I think the balancing, using those and knowing that sometimes those choices will be sort of made in a more blurry reality, was something interesting that we've learned.
Yeah. So coming back to the first part of your comments about digital objects, that's something I'm more or less obsessed with at the moment. And after, just to put in another plug for something else, after people finish with their DataWorks Prize work this week, next week, the first International Fair Digital Objects Forum is taking place in Leiden to discuss exactly all the issues that you were discussing of digital objects, data as a digital object, how PIDs and other kinds of identifiers can help to be tracked throughout the research lifecycle, and different tools and all those things. So I'm really looking forward to that. And I think there's just a cauldron of activity in this whole area, which is, to me, is one of the most, this is where the action is now in research data management, is around PIDs and also ontologies as well. So this is and as you say, it's all rapidly evolving, and you've got the different kinds of PIDs, you've got the ORCIDs, you've got the RIDs, as you said, you've got this new exciting thing announced a couple of weeks ago, where DataCite is now kind of taken over IGSNs on the sample side. So it's all happening, and it's going to be fascinating to see how it plays out, because it's going to be a lot more complex than it's not going to play out, but how it evolves, because different things are going to be happening. I think that we're just in the early stages of kind of almost a revolution in terms of traceability of research objects and the way in which they're characterized. So I think it's a fun time to be involved.
Yeah, I agree. And I did see that forum that's happening next week, and unfortunately I'm not able to attend, but as you said, it's the first one. I do hope it's an annual event, because I could see real value in that.
Yeah, I'll be really surprised if the first isn't followed by a second and a third. So what, just kind of really, really broadening things out, just briefly, what are, you know, other key issues in the area of FAIR and data that are in the front of your mind at the moment?
Yes, I think one relates to what we were talking about around how we can make it easier for researchers to track their research activities throughout the active phase of research. You know, oftentimes when you're thinking about, say, research data sharing, focusing on benefits and requirements, you know, people talk about carrots and sticks. You know, what's the reward or what's for the penalty? But another model that I've often thought about are the sort of the cost-benefit ratios. Not only what is the benefit, but what's the proportion of the benefit that you're getting from the cost that you have to put into it. Not only sort of monetary, but sort of time and effort and personnel, and things that we could do to reduce the cost to researchers of managing their data well, enabling them to manage their data better than they do without any additional effort of theirs. So, for example, I've been talking with some of our researchers engaged with our DataWorks Advisory Committee on formats for microscopes, and that they're known to have proprietary closed formats that don't interoperate with others, not only among research labs, but even within a research lab, you could have an array of different kinds of microscopes being used for research that have a plethora of different kinds of formats that are not interoperable, and that we could play a role in the community in looking how to work on open standards, not only within the researchers, but with the corporations that are producing those research materials, and how to help them realize the benefit of rolling out their materials and their infrastructure in a more standard way. So that's something that we're looking to use, because if you can build it into the tools that the researchers are using to get a better output without them having to put in any more efforts, I think that's a real low-hanging fruit.
It's something I'll just mention.
Yeah, let me respond to each of them before I comment.
Yeah. So just on that point, there's something which you could look into. I can send you more information. It's called Scylla 2. It's an open source protocol that can be used to enable data coming off of equipment to be put in exactly what you're just describing. And it's actually gaining a bit of traction. So that could be something to look into as part of your of that investigation. I'll send you a link. Scylla 2, it's called. But anyway,
that'd be great.
Yeah. So last but not least, as I think you mentioned, I think you actually mentioned earlier in the conversation, you've worked in research data management in the UK as well as the US. So how's that experience informed your thinking? I know it has informed your thinking. And do you have any observations about transatlantic or kind of US-European differences in approach or emphasis to research data management?
So yes, I'm so grateful to have had the opportunity to live and work in the UK. I loved living and working in there. And I did see some differences. Also, a caveat that these are sort of sweeping generalizations that aren't necessarily going to apply in any case. But I think that Europe and the UK specifically has been very forward-thinking for many years with foundational organizations like the Digital Curation Center, the University of Edinburgh, and I know that you've had people from there on your podcast before. And one of the differences that I see is maybe because things are at a different scale at the national level, that there's the ability to have more national conversations around topics like open science, research data management, and the ability to think about how to build integrated infrastructure at the national level. Although that's also being done at the European level, sort of integration and collaboration among different European organizations. And so I think that there's been a real uptake in thinking about how to do things in a structured way, and that centralized services, even sort of mandates, can be helpful in that. So when I used to work for the UK Data Archive, we were the repository, sort of default repository for researchers who were funded by the UK government from the social sciences. And that kind of requirements for a data deposit came out in the UK far before the US. So I think there's a precedent of thinking about what are the interconnections among the different players in the research environment, the connection between the funder and the data repository and the institutions. There are also more, there's more infrastructure for keeping track of research output. So there's something called the REF, or the research evaluation framework, that requires researchers to do formalized reporting of their research outputs in a way that makes tracking of that more built into UK institutions than, say, US institutions. And I think the last thing I'll say is that there's really an effort that I have seen even more in the UK and Europe in learning from other institutions and the value of not simply looking at what your institution is doing well, but really being outward facing. And again, it's not that US institutions don't do that, but I think that there's this value in collaboration and looking outwards that UK and the rest of Europe has really been leaders in.
Yeah, those are all really interesting points. And just as I was listening to you describe them, I was thinking that it seems to me that in the US, partly because it's, as you say, it's distributed, it's big, and also perhaps the institutions are slightly more, each one is off on their own a little bit, although there, obviously there is collaboration, that the role of the professional societies seem to play more of a kind of connecting role, as well as a leadership role in areas like things like research data management. I'm thinking of American Geophysical Union, yes, or FASEB, yeah, would be a good example. So, so that function or role is being filled by you guys to some extent in the U.S. in a way that maybe it's not as needed, or it doesn't seem to appear to be the case in Europe.
Well, that's a really interesting point. And I'll say that I'm glad that you mentioned the AGU. I meant to mention them before, because they've done really fantastic leadership roles and examples in what the role of a scholarly society can play. So we really look to them as a great model and collaborator. And despite what may be seen by the name, you know, the A in FASEB is American, Federation of American Societies for Experimental Biology, we really are an international organization, and our member societies have researchers internationally. And I have great confidence knowing that the ability for us to succeed depends upon the way the international research infrastructure works. And that, yes, we're sort of based and initially sort of oriented nationally, and yet the ability for our researchers to do their work is interrelated with research infrastructure throughout the globe and our ability to collaborate in that.
Fantastic. Well, that's kind of an upbeat note on which to bring the conversation to a close. So, Katie, thanks so much. This has been really an inspiring conversation. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me on, Rory. It was great to talk to you, and I look forward to continuing our conversations.
Me too. Great. All right. Well, that's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed the discussion. The Fair Data Podcast is provided by fairdatapodcast.org and produced by Meroz Ahmed. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts, and follow us on Twitter at Fair Data Podcast. New episodes are released every Wednesday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. UK, 5 p.m. Central European Time, and late in Asia Pacific. See you then.